This week on F8, The Photographer's Perspective, we talk wildlife locations, Acadia National Park, and Sony gear with wildlife and nature photographer Juan Pons. I've been fortunate to work alongside some of the world's most inspiring photographers. I've watched how they've helped others at our conferences and transform the way they see through the lens. Welcome, I'm your host, Chris Smith, founder of Out of Chicago. This is F8, The Photographer's Perspective, the show where we have candid conversations and go in-depth with the pros to get to know them better. Join us each week as we discuss photography, get to know their personal perspectives, and introduce you to new places and experiences, helping you get the most out of your creative passion. Welcome to F8, The Photographer's Perspective. I'm here with my friend Juan Pons. How you doing, Juan?
Oh, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing just fine. Now, Juan is one of my favorite photographers. He's taught at the Out of Chicago conference. He's taught at the Out of Acadia conference with us. He's a wildlife photographer and a nature photographer, and really good at a lot of the technical aspects also, and really good with all the Sony gear. So we're going to talk some Sony gear and Acadia and all sorts of things. So you ready to go?
Very cool. Yes.
Oh, all right. He said that I can ask him whatever I want. So
I may regret having said that. We'll
see. All right. Well, let's see. Let's talk. So you've been doing podcasts for like 10 years now, right? You've run a bunch of different podcasts yourself. That's actually where I got to know you in the first place, the podcast that you did with Rick Salmon. But you've been doing a bunch. But now you're moving away from the podcast, and you've got a brand new Sony YouTube channel. Or is it Sony? Tell us about your YouTube channel.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right in that this coming December would be the 10th anniversary of the Digital Photography Experience podcast that I started with my friend Rick Salmon. And, you know, that we stopped that podcast a few years ago. But yeah, and I've been doing this now for 10 years. And this is the longest I've ever been without hosting a podcast. So it kind of feels a little weird.
Do you want to be the host and I'll be your guest for this episode? Would that make you feel more comfortable?
Maybe. I guess that's why in the past, couple of months, like all these people have come out of the woodwork, podcasts that I've been on over the past 5-6 years, and they've all invited me to come on the podcast. So this is like the sixth one that I've recorded in the past 2 months. So it's kind of cool actually to be more on the other side of the podcast. But yeah, so, I've done the podcast for a long time and I really enjoyed it. You know, it's a great medium and easy way to get out there. But there are a couple of things that made me, when I stopped doing the last podcast, which was the Recompose podcast, I was evaluating whether I was going to start a new podcast on my own or I was going to, or what else. And I thought, I've done the podcast for so long, what is it about the podcast format that I didn't like? And the big thing about it was that it's hard to talk about a visual medium in a non-visual format, in an audio-only format.
For more than 10 years. Maybe that's what it is. You can do it for a little while.
Describing things and talking about them and whatnot. But, there's something to be said about having, visuals to go along with it. And, we put images on the website, for a while there, the very beginning, you could, and you can still do this, but almost nobody that knows does it. You can actually embed images in the podcast feed that show up on people's devices as you're talking.
Right. Is that still available? I know like I would watch like Martin Bailey's podcast and he would do that and he'd be like, oh, and then there were all these swans. I'm like, oh, they're showing up on my, maybe it was an iPod at the time. I don't even know.
Right, yeah. Exactly. It was the iPod or the iPhone with the podcast player from Apple. It certainly works still, is my understanding. But there's a lot of people now that are using other podcast apps. So I'm not sure how it works across that. And to be perfectly honest, my experience was that the vast majority of people were actually listening on the podcast on the vehicle as they were driving. Mm-hmm. So the visual aspect of it was kind of lost in that, within that. And then the other thing that I kind of feel like right now, I keep reading that I read actually quite a bit. And I keep reading that we've reached peak podcast because there are, hundreds of thousands of podcasts out there today. And they kind of get lost within the shuffle. Photography podcasts alone seems like there's 100,000 of them at least. trying to compete in such a crowded field, you know, even though you may have some name recognition, it's still kind of challenging. And, you know, and a challenge that I honestly, I'm not interested in taking because I hate, you know, I do not like marketing personally, and I'm not very good at it. So that's why I decided to do a YouTube channel because, you know, it does the visual stuff, you know, and it's a different medium, different challenges. I have a background in doing video production and video editing. So for me, I know what to do. It's a lot more work for sure. The post-production and preparing and everything is way, 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 way more work. But, you know, it's a different challenge. So, you know, and yes, there are 50 million YouTube channels out there as well as photography YouTube channels. But, you know, it's different. So that's why I decided to take this challenge and see where it goes. And I'll stick with this for a while, maybe a year, 2 years, and see if it takes off. And if it doesn't, then I'll go in a different direction.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. When we talked to our new photographers, we used to ask, you know, like, did you read that on a blog post or what? Like, how did you learn that? And nowadays, 99% of the time, it's like, oh, I watched a YouTube video on that. Like, that's where people are learning now, which is great. So I think to catch on that for sure, it's good.
You're absolutely right. You don't see, you know, there's very few. I mean, there's still people that do these lengthy blog posts, but you don't see those anywhere near as much. And, you know, and I think part of the reason that I was turned off initially about the YouTube stuff is because, you know, when first, you know, a number of years ago, for YouTube videos, they had to be short. And they still kind of need to be short, you know, to keep people's attention. But YouTube itself now actually favors longer form videos where you can actually include a lot more information in them. You know, and I'm someone that doesn't like to just give you the highlights. I like to give you the background behind it. So to, you know, because I truly believe that if you understand how something works, you're more likely to learn it and retain the information as opposed to just someone telling you, do this kind of thing. And the short format videos don't really work that well for that. So you'll see that my videos tend to be on the longer side because of that. You know, I don't know, maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot by doing that, but it seems to be working to a certain extent. But it's not just videos about Sony, even though I've been focusing on that because that seems to be like the most popular thing right now. So a lot of demand, I get a lot of questions. It's insane the number of questions I'm getting from people about different aspects of the Sony gear. So my list of, you know, videos that are in the queue, I want to say it's probably about 70% Sony related stuff because of that.
And we didn't say this, but one of your podcasts was all Sony stuff, right? I mean, right. You're kind of known for that too.
Right. That came out. That was like 4 years ago when, you know, I had recently done the switch to Sony. And when I was contemplating the switch to Sony, at the time, there wasn't a lot of information out there in that it was also very confusing because, you know, there were all these different cameras from Sony and information wasn't very accurate. So that's why I started that podcast thinking, you know, I'm going to be able to help people, you know, kind of sort through that because it took me a while to sort through it. And actually it turned out to be, you know, a good thing because that podcast became super popular, super fast. And I think it's because there was a hunger out there for that information. And when I was doing this channel, I was thinking, you know, maybe I won't focus so much on the Sony stuff because maybe people have figured this out already.
Yeah. Yeah, no, even if they've figured some of it out, there's still like, there's so many people out there that want the details too, and kind of want what you're saying, not just a quick rundown, but really want to know the stuff in depth. Yeah. And what do you think the secret is? Why is Sony, why are they doing so well? This is crazy. You mentioned this to me on the phone the other day. Like, I've never in our years have seen a camera company, you know, just take over like Sony has been doing.
Well, I think there's two things. You know, the biggest thing is that Sony, there's only very few companies that actually manufacture imaging sensors. Sony is by far the largest company that produces imaging sensors. They make more sensors than all the other companies combined.
Meaning they make them for like Nikon cameras and stuff too, right?
Nikon cameras, right. For Fuji, for Hasselblad, you know, for a bunch of different companies, they actually produce the sensors. Because creating a factory, what's called a chip fab or a fabrication facility for creating chips, is actually extremely expensive. It costs billions with a B, billions of dollars to build a plant to fabricate chips. And the process itself is extremely, you know, involved and precise and whatnot. So it's not anybody can do this. So Canon can create their own chips. They're big enough that they have their own fabs. And Sony. Sony produces, you know, chips not just for the different camera manufacturers that we talked about, but they produce chips for the iPhone. It produced chips for a lot of Android phones, you know, for the cars, you know, backup cameras, you know, doorbells, you know, that now have video cameras in them. Just about everything that has video cameras today, chances are that the camera, the sensor that's in there is a Sony chip. So they have an incredible amount of knowledge in developing chips and producing chips. And that gives them a huge advantage. When I was shooting Canon, the beautiful thing about Canon was that they produced their own chips and they were doing way better than anybody else. But Sony really, you know, put a lot of money. They were kind of the upstart, whereas Canon seemed to have rested on their laurels, so to speak, because they were so ahead of anybody at the time. And that they just said, you know, we don't really need to innovate as much. We need to spend as much in R&D. That gives Sony an opportunity to do it. Now, Sony was smart. As opposed to selling chips to companies and, you know, getting a little bit of money for those chips, you know, you can make a lot more money by selling a complete camera. Your margins are much bigger than selling chips. You know, you sell chips in the, you know, hundreds of thousands, not millions of units, and you get, you know, just a couple pennies per unit. Versus with a camera, you know, the margins are much bigger on the cameras. And you could see that Sony had this ambition when they actually bought Minolta a number of years ago to try to bring in that knowledge of SLRs and whatnot into the fold. And they're just very hungry. You know, they're just very hungry in that they're trying to develop new stuff. They're coming out with cameras at incredible speeds. You know, we're seeing new models, like, you know, almost every week, it feels like.
Right, right.
That's what it feels like. And seems, you know,
go ahead.
And they're not afraid, you know. And the big thing about it, I want to say the other big factor, I think, is that they don't have an established product line that they're afraid of cannibalizing, for example, like Canon does or Nikon does. You know, they don't want to put the high-end features of cameras into lower-end cameras because then no one will buy the high-end cameras.
Right. Except on like the video side.
Well, right? Yeah, videos.
I've heard the video guys say that, like the, what is it, FS, whatever video cameras or, you know, like that part, maybe they don't want to cannibalize. So yeah, have the video stuff.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, you cannibalize only a little bit. And, you know, if you look at, for example, one of the reasons why Apple has been so successful, because they recognize, they're like, you know, as opposed to letting anybody else cannibalize our sales, let us cannibalize our own sales.
Right. So,
you know, in a lot of companies, especially big companies, what happens is you develop this fiefdoms within different units, right? These different kind of warlords, if you will, and don't want to cede any ground to any other warlord or fiefdom within the same camera company. They're almost like internal competition. You know, Apple doesn't do that. Apple says, you know, we rather cannibalize the sales from this department, you know, over in our internal department than have a competitor take that business. So that's something to learn. I think that Sony is seeing that because you're seeing a lot of features in the Sony cameras. And then, you know, the high-end video cameras, those guys are going to keep buying the high-end video cameras in most cases because they have a lot of features that, you know, these DSLRs don't have or mirrorless cameras don't have.
Yeah.
You know, just from a usability perspective, they don't compete anywhere near the same plane. So, you know, I think that Sony... and also the other thing that I think that's really important is that Sony has taken a book, a page from Fuji's book, and that they have gone out and started introducing new features to cameras that have been already out there. Canon, you never saw Canon introduce new features with new firmware to a camera. Have you ever saw like maybe two firmwares released updates over the life of a camera? That was, you know, pretty normal. Whereas in Sony, we have seen, you know, we're in version 6 of some of these firmware for some of these cameras. So they've actually continually improved, added more value to existing equipment that's out there. So in the end, not just the fastest or the faster release of new cameras and the R&D, but the fact that you are also gaining value over time with the camera because new features are getting added to the cameras over time.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that, but there just seems to be something in these last 4 years, when you started the podcast and I was looking at possibly switching to Sony like 4 years ago, you know, I looked at it long enough and I'm like, I don't know, they got like this 24-70 f/4 and it doesn't get the best reviews. And I don't know, their lenses look kind of janky, like that 70-200 f/4 kind of looks, I don't know. I just remember thinking, and then they've got like all the little apps that you do on, it just seemed like gimmicky. And now they're at this place where it's like, they're like as professional as anything else or more than anything else that's out there. I don't know how to explain it. Like they've got, when they came out with the 24-105, and like the 12-24, is that what it is? The really wide angle one.
Yeah, 12-24, yeah.
And the 100-400. They came out with those all within like 6 or 8 months or whatever. And I'm like, those are all the lenses I would want. And it's like, now they've got this amazing lens lineup that they just didn't have 4 years ago.
Oh, there is no question about that. And I think that they're, you know, I think they capitalized on something that has changed within the industry as well, is that there is now, you know, software out there that helps you design lenses in a lot that are much better than what they used to be. So they don't have to deal with legacy stuff. In other words, you know, when they came up with 100-400, that lens was sharper than any 100-400 you'd seen by a long shot. Okay. And people say, well, you know, Sony's been, you know, doing great from that perspective, and they are, but the reason is because it's a whole new lens. It's a whole new development, you know, paradigm, if you will, for that particular lens. They use software that allows them to develop a much sharper lens, lighter lens, and whatnot. I would expect that if, you know, when Canon gets around to updating the 100-400, that's going to be very good as well, because that technology is available to them. But even if you look at the Mark II version of the 100-400 Canon, it's what, 5 years old now? Compared to one that's like a year old, you know, that there's a lot of that's happened between, you know, in the last years. As you've seen, there's lots of companies now producing lenses, way more than there's ever been, because it's a lot easier now to produce lenses. The technology is there to do the math and to do the precision grinding of the glass and all that kind of stuff that wasn't necessarily there before.
All right, let's change gears. Do you mind if we change gears? I want to talk about photography.
Not gear.
Good. Gear the whole time. And then I want to come back and I want to geek out on all the Sony gear and talk about the lenses and some of the things you've been checking out. So if you guys want to hear all that stuff and just listen to Juan go on and on, which I want to hear, we'll save that for a little bit later. But I want to talk about, you're going to be one of our instructors next year. It's over a year away at this point, but we're going to do Out of Acadia again. And we did it back in 2016, 2017, something like that. We did it back then, back in the day. And it feels like
ages ago, doesn't it?
Right, yeah, but that's a good thing. But Juan was a huge help in I think I came to you in the very first place. We had like a 2-hour phone call, and I was just like, you know, where could we do this event where we can teach, we can have a city right there, and then we can go out. That was the very first time we did something outside of a city. And he said, well, you got to do Acadia. He goes, that is like the spot. And Juan is just like the guy for Acadia, and he lives near there. So, you know, tell us, what is it that makes Acadia so special for you and really kind of made that event special too?
Well, you know, the nice thing about Acadia is it's, you know, one of the very few national parks on the East Coast. And, you know, and especially in the Northeast. And so from that perspective, you have all this, you know, huge population in the Northeast that doesn't have a lot of options, like a lot of people in the out West where they have tons of different national parks they can go to. So it just becomes a very, very popular destination. But the cool thing about it is that it's very accessible. It's a small place. You can basically, you know, drive to most locations in Acadia. And there's a few places that you may need to hike, but they're not humongously long hikes going to the top of a 14,000 foot mountain or anything like
right.
that.
Right. We went with Thomas Heaton to Beach Mountain. Is that one of them?
Uh-huh.
Is that the right word? Yeah. And we're about halfway up. He goes, a bit generous to call it a mountain, don't you think?
Yes, exactly. But, you know, so because of that, because it's so accessible for most people and for photographers especially, that's why it's such a popular place. Plus, I mean, not just that, it's beautiful. You know, people talk about, you know, the coast, the West Coast of the United States being, you know, breathtaking and dramatic and beautiful. The coast of Maine, in a lot of cases, is just as dramatic and beautiful if you know where to go. The problem is that, you know, the East Coast of the United States is mostly private versus the West Coast of the United States, the coastal is public lands. So you don't have as much access to the East Coast, you know, shoreline, if you will. But Acadia does give you that glimpse into it. You know, with dramatic, you know, sheer drop cliffs and rocks and water. And then, you know, some of the spectacular rock that's there, all the granite that has different colors and different shapes. Like you go to Boulder Beach and you got the round boulders, and then you go to Monument Cove and you got these spires going up, or Otter Point, and you have the sheer cliff. You have a lot of variety. Plus you can also go to the interior and you can photograph loons. You can photograph Bubble Rock, you know, with the bubbles behind, which is kind of an iconic image. You can walk along the carriage trails and photograph some of the absolutely breathtaking bridges, stone bridges that were built on the carriage trails. So there's a lot of different photographic opportunities, you know, from, you know, just general intimate landscapes to sunrise and sunsets, lighthouses and whatnot. Plus, again, being so accessible, and it's relatively small park. So in a very short period of time, you can visit or see or feel like you visited, you know, the vast majority of the park. If you're there for 5 days, you can see, you know, 80% of the park without, you know, really stressing out and having to go to every location and being super, super, super busy. And then it's also right next to a really quaint little town, which is Bar Harbor, which lots of great places to eat. Right on the water with boats that you, sailboats you can go out on, you know, for a sunset cruise. So there's a lot to do in that, just a very small area, which makes it super accessible and super fun to check out.
Yeah, and it's all on, am I right with the name Mount Desert Island, right?
Correct.
Or a big majority of it is, unless you go out on the Skudik Peninsula, right?
Which actually, you know, you went to the Skudik Peninsula when you came to visit it, right?
Yeah, how special it is. It is, and we made you go there on at least one excursion, I know.
Yeah, yes, yeah. We did. That's right. We did go out there. And, you know, it's funny because I've been going out to Acadia for over 20 years, probably about 30 years now. And I used to go to Skudik a long time ago, and you hardly ever saw anybody because it's kind of out of the way. You have to drive or take a ferry. And there weren't any places nearby to stay or to eat or anything like that, but that has changed. Even in the short period since you last went, things have changed, you know, dramatically, and you're seeing a lot more visitors in that area. There's a beautiful new
campground. I was going to say it just opened when we were there. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the campground is absolutely beautiful. Amazing. There's great places to eat nearby. There's places to stay. Really? So it's kind of gotten developed up a little bit since the last time you were there. I mean, it's still the sort of the hidden side of Acadia. Certainly you don't see the crowds that you see in the rest of Acadia, but it is absolutely beautiful, spectacular place.
Yeah, and what I was going to say about the Mount Desert Island is that if you know where to go, when to go, you can do sunrise and sunset. Right?
Right. Yeah. And you can be there, you know, if you go to the right place at the right time, you can be there almost all by yourself as well.
Right. Yeah.
Some other places you'll be there with your, you know, closest friends.
The Boulder Beach, right? Yeah, that one's a little that one can be nuts. Yeah. So if you had a friend that was going to Acadia, a photographer friend, and they just, you know, what are like the three places that I got to make sure I go to? What would you say?
Well, you know, it may sound cliche, but really, I mean, I think that going up to the top of Cadillac Mountain for sunrise is an absolutely special experience. Sunset's nice as well, but sunrise is just really, really neat.
Bring a jacket. It might be a day when it's going to be like 80 or whatever, but it could be like 55 and super, super windy when you get to the top of the mountain.
Super windy at the top. You're right. Yeah. But it is still a really, really interesting, beautiful experience. So I would definitely, that would be one place. The other place I would definitely recommend people go is do that little stretch between Monument Cove, or Monument Cove is not really labeled, so most people won't find it. But if you go between Thunder Hole and down to Boulder Beach, that area along that stretch there, you know, park anywhere and just go out on the rocks and go down by the water and photograph the water, photograph the, you know, the rocks, the seaweed. It's just a beautiful place. So that's definitely another location that I would take people to or recommend that they go. Then the other place, I want to say there's two more.
Oh yeah, you can actually do 10. Go ahead.
The other place, you know, again, it's kind of cliche, but it's also a beautiful location. It's the Bass Harbor Lighthouse.
Yeah, that's the most iconic, probably, right?
Right. It's probably the most iconic. Some people said it's probably the most photographed lighthouse. You know, I'm not in the East Coast. I'm not sure if that's true. I think probably the one in Portland is Portland Head Lighthouse. But it is, beautiful location, just really neat. Again, it can get crowded with photographers, so it's kind of challenging. You want to go there for sunset. As opposed to sunrise, it's nice for sunrise, but the light is not the best as it is for sunset. But that place can get really, really crowded. So you got to get there early. And, over the years, it's just getting crazier and crazier. Just so many more people going there. I used to be that I would go in late September to October, because that's my favorite time to go to Acadia. And you hardly would see anybody there. You'd see tons of people in the summer, but September, October was, you'd see one or two other people there. Now you go in September, October, and there's, 50 people. And there's a very small parking lot, so it's kind of hard. But then the other place that I would go, I would tell people to go, is down the Jessup Trail, which is the boardwalk that takes you through the woods and then takes you to that path that along the aspen trees, the path that's lined with aspen trees.
Gorgeous.
And both the boardwalk and the little path with the aspen trees, it's really neat. And if you have the patience and the time and you like to shoot intimate landscapes and macro, that's the place.
Yeah, the ferns that are growing in there and so many things. Yeah, that was beautiful. And that's what I was going to say, is when we went, you were saying all the diversity of all the things you didn't even mention, like the trail. And when we went, we had Kathleen Clemens and Ann Belmont. They were taking people out there and doing the intimate landscapes and the flower close-ups. And then they went to some of the other gardens too. Like if you're in that was the crazy thing, was we had people leave that event and go, I had to go on this flower thing because other things were filled up or whatever. And they're like, that was my favorite part of the whole thing, was going to photograph like Astiku Garden and Thuya Garden. And
Astiku is the one that's a Japanese garden, right? And then Astiku.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and Thuya is the one that has all the other amazing
dahlias. And when we were there, it was great. Yeah, and you would think, middle of October that, I don't know if there'd be flowers left. That place was crazy with flowers. So,
The other place that I think would be neat, it's one of my favorite hikes in the park, but it's also great for photography, is if you do the loop around Jordan Pond.
We didn't even mention that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely beautiful place that, even if you don't take any images, it is just a really, really neat, it's not a big walk. It's not a long walk, and it's just absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And we went there at night too. Like Chris Nicholson took people and we were doing the stars. And I mean, that just this conversation is reminding me of how much, why this works so well for our events, because so many different things to photograph, and people were shooting there. They were getting up early for sunrise and then they were going and shooting night stuff. And they were like, I've had like 8 hours sleep in the last 3 days. It was like a little crazy, but and that's not good if then you're going down to Boulder Beach, but
I did one night shoot up at the Jordan Lake and I had somebody fall asleep.
Well, I'm not surprised. It's better. That's funny. We've had lots of people fall asleep during presentations, like when we make them do a presentation after lunch or something, but not usually during the excursions.
Yeah, they were so beat up. They were so tired. They were taking images and they kind of like lay down a little bit, and next thing you hear is soft snoring.
That sounds like something I would do. Yeah, that's great. So you'll be with us in Acadia next year. I think it's October 4th through the 8th, 2020. And that's going to be good. You mentioned something about loons. Like, you're really known for is that what you said? You're known for your wildlife photography. But when we, my mother-in-law, my parents and my mother-in-law all came to Acadia with us last year. And she's like, Chris, it was terrible. I didn't see any wildlife. I saw a raccoon or something. I don't know what it's like. I didn't see any wildlife. Like, she thought she was going to see, moose and bear. And, you don't really get that a whole lot, though, like in Acadia, right?
Right. I mean, in Acadia, you will get loons. There is a place that, a lot of people know about and a lot of people don't know about it. I talked about the Jordan Loop Trail, and the exact opposite of the Jordan Pond, basically at the far end of the Jordan Loop Trail, there's an area there that there's almost every year there's a loon that nests in there. Hmm. And they're very accustomed to people because there's a bridge right there. So you end up walking like 20 feet away from the nest, which is kind of neat. And the birds don't get, spooked. But you're right. You don't see a lot of mammals, except for red squirrels, tons of red squirrels. But you do see there's quite a few birds. So you can, if you go to the right place at the right time, in a lot of years, you can see a snowy owl. You can see snowy owls.
Really?
If you, you know, some years they're there, some years they're not. More often than not, they're there lately. So if you go to the right place at the right time, you may be able to see snowy owls. You may see seals as well. Different times of year, the seals may come on shore over by Wonderland. You remember mm-hmm. where Wonderland is? Mm-hmm. But not the rest of the year. So you can see them out swimming quite often. I have seen river otter. Which actually is kind of interesting. You'd think I know all this stuff, but I didn't know it at the time. I saw a river otter in the ocean, coming out of the ocean.
So his name is a river otter. Come on. That's not right.
I know. We don't have sea otters in the East Coast, unfortunately. But, I see river otter, and I have seen, deer obviously in the park. There have been moose spotted in the park and bear spotted in the park, but those are unusual.
Yeah.
So no, you're right. You do not see a lot of big mammals in the park itself. You have to go inland. You have to go, if you go towards Baxter State Park, you know, I go there all the time, and you can see moose quite frequently in there. There's one little pond that I go to that I have seen 7 moose out on it. Whoa. At the same time.
Wow. Crazy. Yeah, so it's a great place. It's just not necessarily for the wildlife. You know, though, when is it when you need to go... like just offshore, I want to say, for puffins.
Yeah, so you don't do that from Acadia itself. You got to go further north than Scudic, but okay. And that's in the summer. July, August is the right time to go. And it is neat if you've never seen puffins. It's a great thing to do. It's challenging to do because they open up. You got to make reservations, like the reservations for the boat. That takes you over, open up at a certain day in February or something like that. And then you get a call right away and make reservations because they fill up for the entire year in literally like a day. Everything's gone.
Mm-hmm. It's like getting tickets to Lollapalooza. Okay. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, and the experience is okay. If you've never seen puffins, it's a great experience because what happens is you go on this boat, which by the way, you're not guaranteed you'll be able to get on the island where the puffins are because if the sea's rough, it's not safe to get off the boat onto mm-hmm. the island. And you get off on the island, you go down these little paths and you go into these blinds and you shoot the puffins from the blinds. So it's not an experience in where you're going to have all these birds flying around you. You're kind of cooped up in the blind shooting at them, but they can be 5-6 feet away from you, which is kind of cool. You don't need super long lenses or anything like that. And if you're lucky, you'll get them coming in with fish in their mouth to feed the chicks if you go at the right time of year. So it can be cool. But it's not necessarily like the most beautiful, mind-bending wildlife experience, if you will.
All right. Which leads to the next question. It's not Acadia. It's not the puffins. What's the world's best, most blind, mind-blowing wildlife experience? Like, what are your favorite places to go when you want to shoot wildlife? And I know you've been leading workshops like for over 15 years now. Like, what are your favorite places to go to?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an easy one for me. For me, I've traveled, all over the world, and, 7 continents and actually 6 continents. But, to me, Yellowstone is still my favorite. One of the first places
In the whole world.
In the whole world. Absolutely. Wow. In the whole world. Because it's one place where you can see a huge variety of animals in a relatively short period of time. A lot of different birds, a lot of different mammals, in an absolutely breathtaking setting, especially in the winter. Winter is my favorite time of the year to go. In the lower 48 states, it has the largest concentration of free roaming wildlife anywhere else in the U.S. Only parts of Alaska have more free roaming wildlife than Yellowstone does.
What's your favorite picture of all your pictures, Juan?
Like the answer, which is your favorite child, right? That's like both a cliche answer and a cliche question.
I'm only cutting you off. I'm not actually asking that question. I take it back. Like my favorite image of yours, and I think you use it a lot, is the one of the bison. They're walking toward you in the winter in the snow. That is just amazing. And that's a Yellowstone, right? That's what you're talking
right.
about.
And you're right. I use that image a lot. And it's definitely one of my favorites. There's no question about it. I use that image a lot because so many people like it so much and it's so attractive. A lot of people get excited when they see the image, and I sold that image a lot. So that's why I use that image quite a bit. But even though it's one of my favorites, it's probably not my favorite from Yellowstone. I would say from Yellowstone itself, one of my favorite images, and I think it's because I have a soft heart for red foxes, is of a red fox walking through a blizzard, and you see the snow just covering the landscape, and the fur on the fox kind of blowing in the wind, kind of showing you not just the fox but also the environment that they're in.
Yeah, and the way the wind is blowing, and the fur is going, and the snow's going with it, you have it at the top of maybe your workshops page or something, one of those. Yeah, I love that shot.
I mean, that's one of my favorite images, just because it evokes an emotion and a feeling about the place. I mean, just like the bison does. But foxes, red foxes, for me, I don't know, there's something about them that just I just love, especially because they set off so well against the white and the starkness of winter.
The
blue colors of a cold day against this red, bright red fox.
They have those in Acadia, right? I could have swore I saw one or two of those when we were driving around Acadia, right?
Absolutely. You may be able to see them in Acadia. I've seen them in Acadia, I think, once or twice. But again, here in the East Coast, I see them a lot more in the West Coast than I see them in the East Coast, just because there's a lot more hunting that happens over here in the East Coast. So they're a lot more elusive and a lot more reserved. So yeah, you could see them. I've seen them in Acadia. If you're lucky, you may be able to see them. The best time to see them is as you're driving. And this is the only times I've seen them in Acadia, is as you're driving at 0:30 in the morning to a location, and all of a sudden you see them crossing the road in front of you.
This is exactly what happened. Yeah, I think I also saw Bigfoot, but that's a different story.
Did you take a picture?
That's the question. No, you got it. It was too fast.
Okay.
So Yellowstone for sure. I just love this idea of Yellowstone in winter too. It's just like I want to say like romantic, but not like in a loving type of way. But I was like, that sounds like such a great adventure. Like, just like, that sounds awesome. Now, when you do your workshops there, do you have to get like, how do you do a workshop in Yellowstone in the winter, right? It's not easy to get around.
Well, yeah. So it is and it isn't. Parts of it are easy to get around. If you go on the North Road, the road that goes between Gardner and Cook City, that road is open all year, even in the winter. Now, sometimes, and I've been there when, the snow is, there's a big snowstorm, the snow is coming down so fast that it's hard to get around. You have to have a 4x4, and even then some of the areas just get huge, huge snowdrifts, and then the park can't keep up with the snow coming in. So it can be a little bit challenging sometimes. But then what happens is, in my workshops that I do there, we spend part of the time on the north end on that road. And it's, by the way, it doesn't seem like it's very long, from Cook City from Cook City to Gardner, it's something like 60 miles, but it can take you all day just to do that run. And the reason is because you end up stopping so many times to photograph different locations, and you may see different animals along the way or a different landscape or whatever. So, even though it's only 60 miles, it may take you an entire day to do that. Usually what I do, my workshops, we leave in the morning, 0:30, to grab a nice sunrise, and then we end up at Cook City for lunch, and then we take a whole half day to get back. So we may do a couple circles around the Lamar Valley because that area is very popular. Lots of wildlife in there if you know where to look. But then the other half of it is, I charter a private snow coach for us, which is snow coach. Used to be these big vehicles with big tracks on them, like tanks that you would go into the park.
That's what I'm picturing.
Mm-hmm. But nowadays, they've actually updated that a little bit. And we have now small buses, if you will, mini buses that have these humongous wheels. The wheels come up to my chest. That's how
these are like the things you see in Iceland sometimes. Is that right?
No, these are even bigger than the ones.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And the whole idea is that the park is doing a little, they have to do a little bit more grooming on the interior roads where you go with a snow coach. But this is a much better experience because it's much more comfortable. It's not as loud. They get much better gas mileage. And this is the reason why they switch from the tracks to the wheel vehicle. So the tracks used to get maybe a mile or two to the gallon. Wow. These ones get about 8 to 10 miles to the gallon. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's, a lot more.
Well, the difference is huge, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the engines don't have to work as hard, so they're actually much more reliable. The other ones tended to break down from time to time because they were under such stress pushing through the snow. So
those are still on roads, though. They're not just like going over open snow.
Yeah. You're still going on the roads that are there all year round. They're just covered. There's usually 4 or 5 feet of snow on top of them.
Gotcha.
And they're groomed. So, but you cannot drive a regular vehicle. You can only go in these, you know, authorized snow coaches to go in.
Right.
The park. And, you know, a lot of people say, what's better, the interior of the park and the snow coaches or the road, you know, the North Road? And, you know, they both are different. The North Road, because anybody can drive it, you end up with a lot more people. And I say a lot, it's not a lot, but you know, can be, if there's wolves hanging out, there can be a big crowd of people there, and you can get a few wolf jams, if you will, where people are, you know, blocking the road because they saw a wolf or something like that. Whereas when you're in the interior of the park, throughout the entire day, you may see a couple dozen people. That's it. You're in the interior of the park all by yourself, really quiet, beautiful place. And a lot of different things or subjects that you can photograph, from animals to waterfalls to rivers to trees, you know, just about everything that you can think of. A much greater variety of animals, but you end up driving a lot more because the distances, as you know, Yellowstone is actually a very big park.
Right.
And the snow coaches are going 25 miles an hour. So if you think about when you're going from one location to the other,
right,
25 miles an hour, it takes a whole day to go from one place to the other.
Yeah.
So you can see some spectacular stuff in the interior that you don't, you may not see on the North Road as well.
And how many days do you do the snow coach, and how many days is the whole workshop?
So usually the whole workshop is a week long. It's from usually or typically from Saturday to Saturday, but not always. And we spend 3 full days on the snow coach. And those days that we're in the snow coach, we're staying at the Old Faithful Snow Lodge, right next to the Old Faithful Geyser, which is in the interior of the park. And the only way you can get there is by snow coach or led on a snowmobile train or tour. So we spend two nights at Old Faithful Snow Lodge and 3 days, full days on the snow coach, basically from sunrise to sundown. And then the rest of the days, which is usually 3.5 days, are spent on the north end.
Wow. All right.
You know, it is, and I know people have heard me on other podcasts before because everybody asked me about this, about Yellowstone. It is by far my favorite place because, you know, it's magical. Yellowstone is magical any time of year, but in the winter is, you know, doubly so because of the snow. Every year is different. The snow is different every year. The quality of the snow is different. The way that the animals are behaving or moving is different from year to year. So that's why after 16 years of doing that trip, every single year, in winter, I don't get tired. That's the workshop that I look forward to the most.
How do we do a out of Yellowstone winter conference? Is it possible? Not possible?
It's possible, but it would be smaller than your typical conference.
Oh.
Yeah, it would be smaller. Otherwise, I mean, you are, I think you'd be compromising. I mean, anytime you're shooting wildlife, when you have a large group of people, it will be difficult.
Yeah, but we would split up. We would be together for a presentation or whatever, but then split up into groups of 8 or 10 or whatever it might be.
Right. And then the challenge here is you know, where do you spend your time? Break up the group between the north end of the park and the south end of the park. And you can't really, I mean, it's difficult to spend time in both together overnight. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So
it is possible. I just don't think that a large group would work as well, but certainly half of the size of what you typically do would probably work. Just, you know, it could be done. It would require quite a bit of planning, but it could definitely be done.
2021.
There you go.
January, is that when you go? Right? That's when.
So yes, January, February are the time, you know, the right times of year to go. The park kind of closes at the end of November or, you know, October, November, and it closes for a little while, and then it reopens around Christmas. And the reason for that is because there's too much snow for vehicles, but not enough snow for snow coaches.
Oh,
so that's why it closes. And then it opens through March, and then it closes again for about 2 months, and then reopens again after that. So it's kind of interesting the way Yellowstone works. And, you know, like glaciers, the same thing. They get so much snow up there that they do close for part of the year. So for me, you can do it from like late December through March, but to me, January, February are the best time.
Yeah. Well, I know that we have a lot of people that follow what we do that are very interested in Yellowstone because I keep telling them we're doing Out of Yosemite, and they go, oh, I can't wait to photograph the wolves and the bison. And I'm like, no, it's not Yosemite. That's Yellowstone. They're like, yes, that's where I want to go.
So it's funny because a lot of people confuse both of them. You know, when I talk about Yellowstone, people, oh yeah, Yosemite, the waterfall and Half Dome. I'm like, no, that's Yosemite.
Right. F8, The Photographer's Perspective is brought to you by Out of Chicago. Out of Chicago brings together passionate enthusiasts with world-class photographers all in one epic location where you learn and shoot side-by-side with the pros. Since 2014, we've organized hands-on photography conferences in Chicago, New York City, Moab, and more. We are all photographers ourselves, so we understand what it takes to be inspired, get to the right place at the right time, and live our best creative life. All right, well, give me a couple more. Where are your other favorite places to do wildlife?
So I think the other place that I think, I like variety. So I like being able to have multiple subjects for me to photograph. A lot of wildlife photographers tend to go to locations where they're focusing on one particular species. You know, and I like that as well. But for workshops themselves, to bring clients in and to give people the best experience possible, I like locations where you have multiple options. You're not limited to one species. So my next favorite place from that perspective is certainly Alaska. Because in Alaska, mm-hmm. you do have a large variety of subjects. You have beautiful landscapes. You have mammals. You have whales. You have eagles. You have sheep. You have icebergs. You have glaciers. And just beautiful, mind-blowing landscapes as well. So, you know, from a variety perspective, that's probably my second favorite place. Now, there are different species that I'm really fond of. And, you know, those I may go to places just to shoot that one species. You know? So that's a little bit different. So, for example, I love muskox. There's something about muskox that are just, you know, really, really draw me in. Maybe because they're kind of look like funny looking bison. And, you know, but to go to those places where you're going to photograph muskox, usually, you know, that's what you're going to go do is photograph muskox. There's not a lot more around those areas as well. So, you know, I may go do that because I'm particularly drawn to a specific subject. But from a location perspective, you know, certainly Yellowstone and Alaska, I think, offer the most variety and the most well-rounded experience.
All right. And what are some of the other places you do your workshops? You said you're going to do Costa Rica next year. We did that.
That's right. I'm doing Costa Rica next year. I'm also putting together another one for Ecuador as well. That's going to go into the Nile into the Amazon. Sorry, not the Nile.
And then the Nile. That would be amazing.
Different continent into the Amazon. And I have a trip going out to Cuba as well. I've done that for a number of years. Not wildlife, but it's more a cultural trip. But for me, I'm originally from Puerto Rico. My first language is Spanish. I have, you know, Puerto Rican culture has a strong affinity to the Cuban culture. They're, you know, kind of intertwined to a certain extent. So I love going to Cuba because I made a lot of friends there over the years. It's a beautiful place, beautiful people. And then I'm doing a trip out to Lofoten out in Norway as well, coming up next year. And then I have a few other things, you know, up my sleeve that I'm not ready to.
Oh, some secrets.
So, all yeah, right. But you know, I think that one of the newest ones that I'm going to be doing is definitely going to be, Costa Rica, which I've been going to Costa Rica for many years. I go there on vacation, actually. I've never done a workshop there, but I have found the right place to do it in. To an area that I absolutely love, that I'm intimate with the area. I know the area really well.
You're going where we went, right? Is this supposed to be a secret or?
No, it's not a secret. This is in the Osa Peninsula.
Yeah, you're going to Crocodile Bay, right? I mean, that's where we just got back from.
Crocodile Bay at the resort in the Osa Peninsula. I don't know if you knew this, but the Osa Peninsula has been rated the most biodiverse place in the world.
Well, of course, we put that in our marketing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is absolutely awesome. I mean, it's a hot place. Kind of the opposite of what Yellowstone in the winter is like.
Yes, it was a little
humid
warm
and hot, but the, you know, the animals and the landscape and the birds, everything about it is absolutely spectacular. I love the whole area of the Osa Peninsula.
And Crocodile Bay is great, and the people there and the guides. I assume you'll be going out with some of the guides there, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you guys missed our out of Costa Rica this year, we're not going to be doing it next year. Yeah, go with Juan. Yeah, for sure. Where do people go? I guess I should say that to find your stuff.
Well, the best place to go is my website. They can go to juanpons.org, or you can find me on Facebook. Also, you can search just for my name, Juan Pons, and you'll be able to find me pretty easily.
I went on your YouTube channel, and I'm like, wait, these are all the questions I was going to ask them, like especially this one. I wanted to ask you, like, what are like two or three things that you see wildlife photographers doing that are amateurs that are like the same things that they kind of always do wrong every time, and they could really make a big difference? This is one of your videos, like five things that they do wrong. And yes. I'm being honest, I apologize. I did not watch it because I wanted to wait and get your answer live here. So what's the answer? What are we doing wrong?
So I think that, you know, that video was prompted because I was just this summer, you know, every year in the summer, I take a long family trip somewhere. We go somewhere kind of cool. And this year I took my family out to Mount Rainier National Park and the Olympic National Park. And when I was in Mount Rainier, which I love, I've been there many times. I used to run workshops there many years ago. I ran workshops there with our friend Rick Salmon. And I was at one of my favorite locations, which was Reflection Lakes. And there was a work, the workshop was at a different location. This wasn't a workshop, it was just a group of people, independent people, friends, I think some of them were. And what I saw them doing was they got there, they set up their tripod and their cameras, and they stayed there in the same spot all morning long through sunrise and after sunrise. They did not move once. So they took the same image over and over and over and over again as the light was changing, which to me was kind of silly. Yeah, you may want to photograph the same location, different lights to see what works best, but take the opportunity while you're there to move around and try to get different perspectives. You know, I was kind of like crawling out of my skin because I wanted to tell these people, why don't you guys move? You know,
and they were shooting landscapes, right? They weren't chasing animals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were chasing animals.
It was just landscapes, you know, just, you know, move around a little bit. This stuff is not going to move. You know, the other thing that did is that it prevented other people from using those same locations, right?
Maybe because that's why they did it.
Down, and then nobody else could shoot from that particular viewpoint, which was kind of a pain in the butt. So, you know, what I did was I would move, you know, from one location to another. And the reason it's good to do that is because, as you know, and as everybody knows, you may have a vision when you get there. You look at the place, this is the right spot, and you make an image there. And you know, but then you bring it home. You're like, it wasn't as good as I thought it was when I was there, right?
Right.
And you look at it.
I know that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, same thing happened to me there. I shot from like five different vantage points, even though I'd been there dozens of times before. And, you know, the one that worked the best when I looked at my images was the last vantage point that I shot from, which was kind of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just thought of these people that were sitting there making the same image over and over again that, you know, if they had messed up the image somehow because they hadn't paid attention to a branch coming in or something like that. You know, that could have totally screwed them up. So that's why I think that moving around is probably the number one mistake that people make.
Not moving around. Yeah. Right. Yeah. How about for wildlife in particular?
It's actually the same. You know, a lot of times, you know, the thing about wildlife, right, is that you cannot, you know, when you're shooting people, you can ask them to move around and get in position and change the relationship to the background, for example. You cannot do that with wildlife.
You got to throw rocks, right? Isn't that that's what you said you do, right?
No. I don't go to game farms either. So where they do pose the animals, I shoot all my wildlife is wild. It's truly wildlife. So what you want to do is you want to move yourself. You want to pay attention to your subject. You want to pay attention to your foreground and your background and trying to work out in your head as you're looking through the viewfinder, excuse me, you know, where can you move yourself to rearrange the elements in your scene so that you can change, you know, what's in the background of that animal that you're shooting to, you know, arrange or compose, if you will, the image based on what's in front of you. To optimize the elements, you know, make sure that there's nothing growing out of their head, or you have a branch that's coming in and obscuring it, or that you balance the image. If you have a very strong subject on the left for your wildlife, you have a strong subject on your right with, you know, the landscape or something along those lines. So moving around, I think it's, again, super important. And it's not just moving the camera, it's moving yourself. You know, maybe it's moving 2 feet to the left, 5 feet to the right, moving up, getting down on your belly, changing that perspective.
Right. Yeah, I've said that to people. Like, you got to move. And I feel like sometimes, and I remember when I first started just thinking, you know, just turning my camera, pointing it up, down, left, and right. Like, I got lots of different choices here. But it's not until you put your camera down near the ground or put it up as high as possible or, you know, like you said, totally move where you are that you start to see things different ways. So that's interesting.
And again, it's amazing to me how people, you know, both in landscape and in wildlife, they'll see something and they'll stand and just sit there and take the same shot over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my approach is, especially with wildlife, you know, if I see something, yes, I'll take a shot right from where I am. I call that my safe shot because, mm-hmm. you know, that animal may just scamper off right away and that was the only opportunity you had, right? But as once you get that safe shot, you start wanting to work the image more. You know, like you see this in movies and whatnot, right? The photographer's telling the models, work it, work it, work it.
Work it, baby.
They're getting, the model to do things. You know, it's the reverse. We have to be the ones moving down.
Right, right.
To try to move those elements and put them into place.
Yeah. Well, it's really that idea of it's the photographer's their job to make the image and not just take an image. You don't just, right. You just don't shoot. You're composing, like you said, with the landscape over here and the animal over here, and you got to move into a position to make that happen. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. No, absolutely. Yeah. To me, that's kind of like the biggest mistake I see people make all the time. And it's, you know, and that's why I call these mistakes nature photographers make, because it's both wildlife and landscapes as well.
Yeah.
It applies to both.
I did not expect that to apply to the wildlife. I was like, okay, let's do something totally different now for wildlife. That's a really good advice. So yeah, I like it. All right. Let's do some, you know, we could end the podcast here and be like, that was great. It was wonderful. It's a full podcast, but can we just geek out on some Sony stuff? Are you good Absolutely. With that? All right.
Let's do it.
Let's do this one first. What do you think about the A7R4?
Well, mine should be shipping any day now, you know, tomorrow or the day after. So I placed the order for it. I got to go. Sony invited me to an event in New York to actually get hands-on with a camera. And I liked it a lot. I think that, again, it's not a revolutionary product. It's an evolutionary product from the Mark III to the Mark IV. They've, you know, refined it and improved it. The ergonomics are much better. I mean, I love the ergonomics of the R3. Or I thought I loved the ergonomics of the R3.
Right?
Mm-hmm. R4. The grip is better, more contoured. The way that the buttons feel are more tactile.
The joystick thing is different, right?
The little joystick is a lot better. You know, has a little bit more throw to it. Plus, it feels a lot better in the hand. The shutter is angled, so it actually feels a lot better to press. And it feels better as well from a tactile perspective. The buttons, all the buttons are slightly bigger on the back as well. The only thing that's not bigger, which is the biggest disappointment to me, is the wheel on the back. That wheel is
Yeah.
I'm used to the Canon. Agree. You know, I came from Canon. Canon has this big wheel on the back that's really nice and easy to use. The Sony.
Right. And it doesn't have any buttons with it, right?
And it has buttons in it too, which, you know, it can be a pain in the butt because you can press them.
The wheel itself is buttons, right? I mean, the Canon one was never like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Up, down, left, right, and then you press it in. So it's kind of sucky. That's my biggest, you know, usability pet peeve about the camera. But
although you use it in a lot different way, right? Because that on the Canon was your exposure compensation, and now it's up on top, right?
Right. But the problem is that little wheel is kind of sensitive, especially if you're wearing gloves. It's easy to click one of the options. And what you have in that wheel is you have your ISO or your drive modes. I mean, you can program it to be whatever, but typically you have your ISO on the right, the drive modes on the left. So you end up pushing it by mistake, especially with gloves, and you end up changing it unless you lock the thing, which I sometimes do. I lock.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, and we had people do that in Costa Rica, and I did it once just not that long ago because you hit the ISO button one time, and it goes. I think I had it in like auto ISO, and I bumped it up one, which is now 7 million ISO.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. It jumps up to. It never jumps up to like 50. It jumps always to like 7 million. Right. You're absolutely right. So, But you know, a lot of things people were also asking about the 61 megapixels. People, I don't need 61 megapixels. I'm not printing billboards. I'm not printing big stuff and whatnot. And you know, and that's right. You're not doing that. But you know what? 61 megapixels. The reason I'm excited about 61 megapixels is because that gives you more ability to crop. So you can make your lenses longer, if you will.
Well, it'd be just like using a crop sensor camera, exactly. Just using part of the image. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the camera has a crop sensor mode that you can turn on, and then the pictures are like 24 megapixels in the crop sensor mode. But you know, why do that when you can just crop in, you know, in
right. If you cut off a tail or something like that, you could have had it with just the full sensor.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, that to me, it's not so much that I want the 61 megapixels because I'm going to be printing billboard size images. It's more because it gives me the ability to crop more into the image and have more pixels to work with after the fact. So that's why I'm excited about the 61 megapixels. The autofocus is also better. It's been improved over the R3. The R3 is really good autofocus, not as good as the A9, but is really good. And I think that with the 4, it'll be a little bit better. It'll get us there a little bit more. So I think that that's a big improvement. And the reason I say that is because when I was shooting, so I have both the A9 and the A7 R3.
And that's what I want to ask, which one do you use? But finish your thought too.
Right. No, this is good because I use... It's like you read my mind because I use the R3 90% of the time.
Really?
The only time I use the A9 is when I'm shooting birds in flight or, you know, very fast moving subjects, which are typically just birds in flight. And the reason for that is because the A9 is only 24 megapixels and it does not have the dynamic range of the R3.
You can see the difference.
Oh yeah. You can definitely see the difference, especially in low light. So even though you think it would do better in low light, but in my experience, the R3 does better in low light. So that's why I use the R3 90% of the time. But one of the challenges with the R3 is that if you have a 100 to 400 and you put a teleconverter, now you're shooting at F8, right? When you're at the long end, because the lens is at 5.6, you put a 1.4 teleconverter, you end up at F8. The R3 cannot track a subject. It can focus on the subject, but if you press that button down, even though you have it in continuous autofocus, it will not be able to track a subject because the light level is too low. The A9 can track it. So my hope is that with the R4, it will be able to track even at F8. I was not able to test that when I was in New York because I did not have, you know, a 100, 400 and a teleconverter I could put on the camera to try it. But I believe that it will be able to do it. I'll find out in the next few days when the camera arrives. That's the very first thing I'm going to test. But then again, now with the new 200 to 600 that's out, that's not going to be an issue because that you'll be able to, there you go. Yeah. You'll be able to, yeah, that's a 7.1 on the long end, right? So you'll you'll be able to track, focus track with that, even with the R3.
I was thinking it was 6.3, but I guess I don't really know.
Yeah, I think it's 6.3 or 7.1.
The video on it.
Yeah. I'm not very good to remember all these numbers. So so that to me was kind of one of the big things is that, you know, if I can get that extra bit of autofocus performance out of it, out of the R4 versus the R3, it's, you know, that's another plus in addition to the 61 megapixel.
So how about this one? You kind of just mentioned the teleconverter on the 100 to 400. Is that something you use quite a bit? Like I was wondering when I was in Costa Rica and things are dark too, I've got the 100 to 400 and I had the 1.4 teleconverter and I'm like, I don't know if I should use it. I should just like crop in a little bit. What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, I use that teleconverter with it all the time. I was, when I first got the 100 to 400 and you know, I was testing it, I was blown away by how good the performance was of the 100-400 when you put that teleconverter on. When I did some test shots around my yard and of birds and whatnot, I could hardly tell the difference between when I had the teleconverter on and when I didn't. So I actually did some test charts to see. And the performance was, the difference was minuscule. It was irrelevant to, you know, whether you were using it or not. Certainly, again, like you noticed, you lose some f-stop. And you lose some performance on the autofocus on the camera. So if you could compensate for those some other how, absolutely, I use it all the time. As a matter of fact, I used it all of the time. You know, I probably shot more with it on than with it off.
Really?
By the way, this is the only time that I've ever recommended someone use a teleconverter with a zoom lens. Because typically, when you put a teleconverter in a zoom lens, you lose too much image quality, too much, right. You know, autofocus performance. Sony was the first system that I ever felt confident telling people you could do this without a problem.
Huh.
I used it all the time. Now with the 200, 600, that may not be, you know, as big an issue. But the performance of the 200 to 600 with the 1.4 teleconverter is still very, very, very good. So, you know, I may end up using it less, but I still won't hesitate to use it. Wow. If I can, you know, obviously, like you said, in Costa Rica, you were under the canopy.
All right.
It's very dark. Even then, during the middle of the day, it can be very dark in there. So you're shooting with, you know, really high ISOs. And I was shooting, 6,400 regularly, you mm-hmm. know, when you're on the canopy yeah. in Costa Rica, for sure.
Yeah. So do you still, I think when you first went to Sony, you were using some of your Canon lenses with the adapter. Do you still, because you had some of the really expensive prime lenses, whatever. Do you still use those or have you gotten any of the new Sony really expensive lenses?
Well, you know, no, I don't use my Canon 500. As a matter of fact, yesterday I put it up for sale.
Oh.
I haven't used it in over 2 years.
Wow.
I haven't used it since the 100, 400 came out. I have not used the 500. I still have the adapter. And that's the only Canon lens I still own. And it took me a while to sell it just because I was so attached. I've had that lens for so long. And
yeah.
It was my absolute favorite lens that I felt like I couldn't sell it. You know, I would feel like I was, you know, selling a child or something.
You're missing out on like just those super great backgrounds the F4 500 millimeters gives you?
No, because, you know, when you're shooting at long distances, you know, it's not as big an issue with that out of creamy background. Oftentimes when you're shooting an animal, you know, you'll have your background is further out as well. Now, in places like Costa Rica, like you're saying, your background is a little closer. So yes, I'm missing a little bit of that, you know, autofocus background in those situations. But again, the depth of field at 500 millimeters with the prime and at 560 with the 1.4 and the 100-400, you know, the field or the depth of field is pretty similar to one and the other. So you're not going to get, you know, because when you're shooting, as you know, depth of field grows with distance, right? And when you're mm-hmm. shooting something that's far away, that depth of field is going to be long anyways. So yes, there's a sort of fine line in there where one would have given me the advantage over the other, but guess what? Not having to hold that humongous lens
and carry it
travel with it and all that stuff is well worth that sacrifice.
Wow.
So I think the advantages, you know, overwhelm the disadvantages of using the smaller lenses and the 100-400 teleconverter.
And you find that
literally yesterday I put it up for sale.
Oh, jeez. And you find that the quality of the bokeh, whatever you want to call it, is good enough too. Because I remember seeing like people's presentations like 5-8 years ago where they did all wildlife photography with like a really old Sigma or Tamron lens, which they've gotten so much better. But to see their out of focus backgrounds got all this really, really weird stuff. But that's not the case with this.
That's not the case at all. No, it actually produces incredibly beautiful bokeh, even with a teleconverter. So no, I've not seen that issue at all.
Yeah, I think it's great too. I just thought maybe to your eye, it wouldn't quite be there. So here's what I've learned essentially now. If you usually use the A7 R3, maybe now the 4, and the 100 to 400 in the teleconverter, like I have all the same things that the great Juan Ponce has.
Yes.
I can't believe it. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, supposedly there's going to be an A9 Mark II coming out.
Ah, that's one of my questions here too. What's that all about?
So who knows, you know, so good about keeping their stuff close to the vest.
Like that A7 R4, no one had any clue that was coming, right?
No clue whatsoever. It caught everybody by surprise. So Sony's doing something right from that perspective, keeping their secrets. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, the beautiful thing about the A9 is the autofocus system is just out of this world. It's giddy when you use that thing, because every single image that you shoot at an animal coming at you is beautifully sharp, 99% of them. Plus, the biggest advantage of it is also the no blackout viewfinder.
Right.
So it feels like a video game. You're shooting, you're taking a picture, and you see, you never get that blackout that you used to get with the DSLR.
How do you even know that it is taking a picture?
Well, yeah, so you can turn the sound on. You know, it's got a little fake sound to it, mm-hmm. like a fake shutter sound, because the shutter's not going. Or there's also, you can make this little marquee flash in the viewfinder.
Okay.
So the pictures, in case you're pushing that button by accident, right? But if you turn those two things off, you have no idea, except you see the picture counter go down. you know, the frame rate of 20 frames a second is great, but you know, honestly, I don't use it that often. I'm usually shooting at medium, because 20 frames a second is so insanely fast. Only when I'm shooting an eagle coming in, you know, super fast to pick something out of the water, will I want it at 20 frames a second. Otherwise, my cards are only going to last me 5 minutes because they just get filled up. So, right. You know, if, you know, my ideal camera would be, you know, if I have something like a 42 megapixel that could take 15 frames a second and still have the dynamic range of the A7 R3 and the autofocus system of the A9.
Yeah. And now, the no blackout. Yeah.
And the no blackout would be a bonus. Now, if the A9 Mark III or Mark II comes close to that, then it'll be great. But if it doesn't, you know, for the longest time, since the R3 came out, I've actually wondered if I should sell my A9, because my A9 gets so little use. It's almost the world's most expensive backup camera. Because the only time it comes out of my bag is when I'm shooting birds in flight, which I don't do as much anymore. So I'd rather give up a little bit of performance on frame rate and on autofocus and get the, you know, bigger image and or, you
the know, dynamic megapixels. Range.
And the dynamic range. So that's why, you know, I didn't hesitate to jump to the R4. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with the R, you know. So the question will be, when I get this camera and I'm going to wait till the A9 Mark II comes out, what's going to be in my bag? Is it going to be the R3 and the R4? Or is it going to be the A9 and the R4? Or what? I'm not sure. We'll see.
We'll see. So my personal question for me was, Should I think about getting an A9, or maybe I can borrow yours, Juan, or should I rent one? Because the one time I finally got to use the 200 to 600, it came like 2 days. It was shipped like 2 days after we got back from Costa Rica. That was a bummer. But I finally got to use it for all my daughter's soccer games. I'm like, this is great. But there were times when it was like, you know, the kids would be running or whatever. And it's like, you know, the shot right in between those was probably the perfect one. I wish I just had a slightly higher frame rate. What do you think? It'd be a little better for that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's no question. It'll be better for that. And it'll get much better out of focus. But at this point, I think I would wait until see what the R3 or the R2, sorry, the A9 Mark II is.
Yeah. You know?
Because we're talking about October announcement in October, so it means it may come out in November.
Is that what the rumors are saying?
Yeah. So it'll be either late this month or next month when it's announced. And the way that Sony is doing things is that they make the announcement and then the camera is available and released within 2 to 3 weeks, typically. Now, yeah. Sony just announced a bunch of other cameras, including the 6400.
That was my last question.
So 6600 and the 6100. And those are not going to be available till November or October.
Okay.
But if you look at that 6600, that has basically the same autofocus system as the A9.
So that's what I was going to ask. Would one of those be a consideration for my daughter's soccer games?
So, you know, yes, it's a crop sensor. So you have to take that into account. And it's 11 frames a second. My biggest pet peeve with the 6000 series of cameras, I love those, but the problem is that they're very, very small body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I have small hands, you know, I wouldn't say small hands, but you know, relatively small hands, and holding that camera when I'm shooting wildlife is actually kind of painful. My hands hurt because it's so small. I'm gripping it so tight and my grip is so tight around the camera. It's not as bulky as it would be with like a series seven camera. That I cannot do it for a very long period of time.
Yeah.
So that's a consideration. And you know, and then the dynamic range is not the same. Also, I think the A9 sensor is better, has better dynamic range than the 6600. But, you know, if you need a camera with a really good autofocus system, you know, that doesn't break the bank like the A9
right,
would,
right. Mm-hmm.
The 6600 yes, is a huge consideration for sure.
All right. So, all right. Good advice.
And again, you get the crop factor in there. What you're going to give up on is going to be mostly the blackout free viewfinder, and the frame rate, and then a little bit of image quality.
So I just borrow your A9.
There you go.
Thanks, Juan. Yeah. You're the best.
It looks brand new because I've used it. I mean, I've used it a lot, but it's not my workhorse. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah. Whereas if you look at my R3, it's actually beat up quite a bit because I've hiked, you know, I was hiking it at night in Costa Rica down a couple of creeks and rivers. So, you know, it got a little beat up. And it looks like it's brand new. And I'm usually one to really take good care of my camera gear, but the R3 has gotten a lot of use.
Yeah, it is a great camera for sure. And I can't wait to hear what you think about the R4 once you've had it for a while. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping to get it by Friday. It should arrive here home by Friday. I'm going to play with it over the weekend and do some tests with it. You know, the thing is, you know, and I'll have something on the YouTube channel about this. The problem is, or not the problem, is that I'm not one of those people that the camera comes in, I immediately start taking pictures of my cat and my dog, and then make a review, you know, 4 hours later about, you know, how the camera performs shooting my cat or my dog around the house. That's not me. There's plenty of people that do that. They want to be the first ones out there and be the first ones to review. That is not me. I will go out with the camera, take it out on a real shoot somewhere and use it like I would normally use it, not taking pictures of my cat or I don't have a cat, but my dog.
Right, right.
And so my review, I may give like a first impressions, but my review will take longer. It'll be a few weeks until I have real time to use it. Luckily, I'm heading out to Jackson into Wyoming and Yellowstone on the 20th of the month. So just a few days after I get the camera, so I'll be able to put it through its paces in Yellowstone, which will be
awesome. Fun. Awesome. All right. Well, you're going to have to help us plan that trip because that's going to be a good one out of Jackson Hole, out of Yellowstone, whatever, something out there. We got to do it.
Yeah, no, that would be a spectacular location. I'm sure lots of people would love to go on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, me, as long as I want to go, that's the most important thing. That's all that really matters. And that you'll go with us. All right, good. All right. So we can just search for Juan Pons. Pons is P-O-N-S. And we could probably do that on YouTube as well for your YouTube channel. Is that right?
That's right. Or it's actually youtube.com/Juan Pons.
Perfect. So check out the workshops, check out the new channel on YouTube. And yeah, we'll miss, I don't know. I'm sure you'll start another podcast soon. He just hasn't said what it is yet.
Who knows? Who knows?
All right. Awesome. Anything else you want to throw in before we cut you off here?
No, that's about it. Looking forward to Out of Acadia again. And yeah. I may actually see you in October out in Oregon. I may be out there that way.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, stop by for sure. That'd be really good. Thank you, Juan Pons. And we'll maybe see you in Oregon.
Sounds good.
Talk soon. Thank you. F8, The Photographer's Perspective is hosted by me, Chris Smith, and produced by Out of Chicago. A special thanks to all photographers that share their inside knowledge to make this possible. We release a new episode each week, so be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts are found. To learn more about Out of Chicago and upcoming events, go to outofchicago.com. Subscribe to our mailing list to stay connected and be the first to know of our next new location where you can shoot side by side with the pros.